about the whole United States. Until now, the highest being used was 52. Alright, the highest channel before transition is 54. Okay, you're called WS2X, go ahead with your question.
Since you're on the over-the-air topic for TV, I want to give you one update. I wound up getting another box. What happened was last week Eric said Channel 4 had moved. He said it went to a different building. You might be able to get it. Sure enough, I was able to get it on one of my other boxes. You know. But the one box was definitely screwed up here. RCA box, it won't scan anymore, so I gave up with that. When I got another one, I think you'd be interested in this. Made by E-Matic. And I hooked that up. I mean, instantaneously, this thing scanned through everything probably in about 2 minutes. Got all the channels. But it's very good. I mean, you know, it's got a HDMI plug in the back, USB, you can hook a hard drive up to it, calling cables, the whole bit. Very good. It's made by E-Matic. Back to you.
How expensive is that thing, Paul?
It was $49, but I got $10 off. My wife had some kind of a coupon thing, so over in that Target I got it. But you could hook this thing up with a hard drive into the USB, and you'd be able to record anything you wanted. You could even record in HD. So I know you were talking about that last week. You don't have that capability to record, but this one you could. And then you can go out and get a $50 terabyte drive and just plug it in. And you'll be able to record a lot of stuff. And that's the advantage of having it. See, with your setup, you're plugged directly into your Vizio. You know, and that, now you're out of luck. You can't really record anything, as far as I know. But with this thing, you could send it through the box, watch TV, and then also record. I can record anyway. I have the component cable, so I just plug it into a DVD recorder. If you wanted to, you could go one step further and go out and get a hard drive. Back to you there.
First comment about that? Yeah, I think the Vizio has a USB output and input. Sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, one thing I will tell you about that DVR type of setup is that, first of all, it's actually recording the stream, so it's breaking down the audio and video the way you would think. Some of the channels use copy protection, so it will record on the hard drive and play back to the monitor. But if you try to hook it to a DVD recorder, it will say it's copy protected and won't record it.
When it comes to Eric's original question about signal-to-noise ratio, assuming he's in a quiet area and there's no co-channel interference, he's able to calculate what the noise floor is, and therefore knowing the DBMV or carrier signal strength in microvolts, he can make a calculation of signal-to-noise ratio, carrier-to-noise ratio, a rough one at the RF front end. That would be the first step. That's the best floor you're going to get. Then you add in a factor of whether or not the neighbor has a fish tank heater that's got sparking contacts and it's making local noise. Then you can also add in whether or not you're getting co-channel interference. I am guessing the most detrimental kind of digital television reception, the most detrimental thing, would be co-channel interference, something that's on essentially the exact same frequency and creating inter-symbol distortion. Is that roughly true, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, actually, that's exactly true. That's one of the sources. By the way, I meant to say to Joe Mellor-Y before that when he turns and rotates his antenna, if he had a receiver that actually gave you the actual numbers of what the error correction and the equalizer is doing in the set, even though he never loses the signal, if he was actually going to meter that number would go from probably you know, I've seen, like, here I get about 32, 33 dB, or an EVM of 0.7, 0.8. As you rotate the antenna, that number is going to increase and decrease, but it never gets below the threshold where the picture unlocks. But you'll be, when the error correction gets really big, has a really hard time, that's when you'll see macro blocking, where you see some of the pixels get all messed up.
And WSI, just one quick comment for Eric about Channel 4. I don't know what you said. If they switched from Empire to the One World Trade, did they do that or not? Because that, now I'm getting Channel 4 100%. All the years I've been doing this, never could get 4 ever. Now I get it on three different boxes, the two old boxes, plus this new one that I just got.
Channel 4 is simultaneously on two different transmitters. One is coming from the World Trade Center, and it is virtually branded 4-3 and 4-4, even though it's coming from Channel 36, and they're still transmitting from Empire, which is 4-1 and 4-2, and that's on Channel 28.
Okay, I'm getting 4-3 and 4-4, the new one.
Yeah, I'm getting all four. 4-1, 2, 3, and 4. 4-1 and 3 are identical to programming. 4-2 and 4-4 are identical programming. Now I see what's going on. This ematic converter that you got from Target, I think, for $49 a call, does it have nice features? In other words, is there a way that you can tell it bit error rate, carry the noise ratio, single strength like that? Can you, it scans very fast and does a lockup on all of those channels. Can you easily add and subtract channels? What kind of features does it have? Does it give you programming information across the screen that's easy to read if you're more than 5 feet from the screen? WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Closed caption works great. Plus you can change the size of the font. The program guides, they just give you whatever channel you're on, they'll give you what channel, whatever you're watching, plus the next show that's coming on. Reading the book, if you hook up the hard drive, I think they give you a lot more on the guide, plus you'll be able to just click on it to record those stations, you know, instead of actually setting times or doing anything like that. The remote control comes with, you know, when you're looking at it, you can see play, fast forward, reverse. It looks like a regular recording device. One thing it doesn't have is you can't turn your TV on with it. It doesn't have that combination system. So, you know, you really got to use two remotes, one to turn the TV on and one to turn the convertible on. And that's pretty much it, I guess. But it'll show you what channel, whatever channel you're on, pretty bright screen that you're looking at. It's made out of pretty substantial shiny metal. It doesn't feel like a cheap and expensive one like the RCA was.
Well, does that thing have an Ethernet connector or Wi-Fi in it?
I believe it's got the Ethernet. I'll have to look at the back again. The front has the USB. The back has the HDMI, RF in, RF out, and it's got the component cable, which I hooked up to the DVD recorder. By the way, I tried recording it, no problem, by the way, on the station anyway that I recorded on. I ran a test on that.
Now, the reason why I asked if there was either Ethernet or Wi-Fi in it is that, you know, you're essentially making a TiVo. And for it really to be effective, you need to know what's on next week, you know, at all hours of the day, in order to be able to program to capture the programs that you want. And the easiest way to do that is to get it off the internet. There are a number of boxes that do that. I was just curious if that one does it or not.
I didn't see any connection on that. Probably not. But maybe somehow you could get into that USB port. There's a way to do that. Maybe you could put a USB bus there or something. I don't know. They talk about being able to look like 6 days in advance, so to do that, I guess you do have to get onto the internet somehow. But no Wi-Fi. Definitely not. It would have to be hardwired in.
Paul, is there a way of knowing the maximum number of lines of resolution that Hematic is able to give you? Do you know the maximum number of lines? Obviously, it's not going to go to 4K. And even if it did, I don't think my set can display 4K. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it's at 1080 in my book. It's hooked up to a CRT screen. I haven't hooked up to my smart screen TV. No reason to do that. That one I have hooked up to cable. All my boxes are hooked up to CRT.
Here's a question for Eric. Assuming now I did have an external converter box that's capable of going to 4K, and my set with its built-in demodulator goes to, let's say, 1,200 lines, I presume using my set as a monitor, there's no way you could display 4K, even if the external converter is supplying it. I am guessing that's true. Give me a confirmation, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Now, your display is 1080i, it's not 4K, right?
Roger.
Okay, if you used an HDMI cable and plugged it into something that was making 4K, you would see nothing but flash. Very simple. It's a different protocol. And by the way, Paul, it's all about the software in the box. You know, if it doesn't know anything about Wi-Fi or Ethernet connection, then the software is not going to reflect that. And even if you put, say, a Wi-Fi dongle into it, it's not going to know what to do with it. So, and the box that he has to do 1080i, that's the maximum you can get out of broadcast. You'll get 1080p, progressive, from some Blu-ray players. That's easy to do. But if we were going to transmit MPEG-2 1080p over the air, we would be taking up something like 12 or 15 megahertz, and that's a no-no.
By the way, Dick, it's an 18103B, if you want to look it up. 18103B.
I thank you, Paul. I think you're saying, Eric, the greatest number of lines being transmitted are 1080i over the air. That if I had the right kind of a cable or satellite system or Blu-ray, I'd get more lines. Is there any future intent to transmit over the air greater than 1080i? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Actually, next week the FCC meets, and actually this coming week, to iron out the standards for ATSC-3. The ATSC-3, at this stage of the game, right now, today, we'll transmit Ultra HD, which is what you call 4K. It's really 3.5K. And the standard will support, with the newer compression, doing 8K. By the way, there's 8K cameras now, 8K monitors. That's getting silly, but there's this thing called wide gamut, and what do they call that? It's more bits, multiple colors. I can't, the brain's not functioning right now. Which, of course, takes up bandwidth, or takes up space, but with the compression schemes that we have, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you don't think about 1080i. I mean, there's 1080 visible lines, and there's 1920 pixels on a line. Yeah, and you finally add that matrix up, that's a lot of pixels.
It's around 2 mega. I think it's around 2 megapixels. Is that roughly true, Eric?
Yeah, that's about right. And ultra high depth is 330,000. I did look it up. I didn't know this number on the top of my head, but I don't. It's, I think it's 3,700 lines. Whereas 4K is actually 4024, I think it is. Which we don't transmit. And the aspect ratio is a little bit different. It's used in filming, you know.
And WS2 on 1 4 comma for you there.
Great, Paul.
The directions or the information on the in the booklet tells you that it's compatible with Vizio, so maybe they got something to do with them. Or with all the TVs out there, the only one that they said was compatible with all Vizio sets. I'm sure they're compatible with everything, but they actually make that statement.
You know, that the statement really means is that it's compatible with the way the TVs communicate, meaning you can talk to the set and probably turn it on and off and all that other stuff.
Very nice. So, once again, Eric, you told me, and I think I've forgotten already, over the air broadcast, right now 1080i is the highest, and I think you're saying that the FCC is going to hold a meeting about ATS-3 this coming week. And make a rough guess. What do you think is the maximum number of lines of resolution that will be over the air in the near future? K2EJ, K2IW.
K2IW, K2EJ. Well, if Sinclair has their way, come sometime by the summer, if the FCC does their approval. By the way, there's people arguing that there's going to be chaos because at this point there's no one standard method of transmission with ATSC-3. There's like 6 or 7 different methods, different types of applications. So there's some folks out there screaming chaos, and then there's other folks, actually there's other political folks, politicians that are complaining that you can't all of a sudden put your nice high-def picture on an APS-B transmitter to reduce rate while you put the nice high def picture on ATSC-3, because the football fans are going to get all upset because they don't have the gear for ATSC-3. Now all of a sudden you've made their nice high def picture low def, and they're going to be unhappy about it. So there's that argument out there. So it's a little bit of a turmoil at the moment. Nobody's quite sure what's going to happen, but let me let it drop. If Sinclair has their way, you're going to be seeing ultra-high def right off the bat. Actually, there's a bunch of them that want to do that. By the way, if you have a 4K set now or an ultra-high def set, you can actually plug it into your correct DirecTV box, the one specifically made for it, or the correct Verizon box, the one specifically made for it, and watch 4K movies if you can shell the money out of your pocket. It's no longer a baby technology, it's becoming a little more mature. The only part that's lacking from it here, where it's not lacking in Korea, is the ATSC and the standards that we're going to use. Whereas in Korea, they've been doing it for a year now, and it's like they're doing less and less high def and more ultra high def because the audience loves it. And I guess we'll see. But to answer your question, there really is no limitation in terms of how many lines you can transmit. It's all about mathematics. It's all about calculus. It's about the ability to come up with these schemes that do compression, and you trade off artifacts for it. If you go way back into the late 80s and the early 90s, limit at a drop, when the first group of guys created the Motion Picture Experts group, and they created what was called MPEG-1, which was actually an outgrowth of something called Motion JPEG, which had been used at that point. the different layers of compression, whereas motion JPEG is actually closer to real, and MPEG is a pseudonym for what's real. What it wound up being is a scheme using discrete cosine transforms to be able to take a matrix and reduce it into a single number or a group of numbers or a block of numbers. Actually, our current system is based on an 8x8 matrix to represent huge blocks of the screen. By using these DCTs and inverse DCTs and some other techniques, some of them call up run-length encoding. Run-length encoding is a cute little scheme where it's basically, instead of, if you have 100 pictures in a row and they're all 255, instead of transmitting 100 bytes, you would transmit 3 bytes. One byte that says, I am sending you a shortened thing, and it's for this number of pixels sequentially, and it's at this value. There are a lot of techniques. As math goes on, and we learn more and more about this eyeball spatial response and the human emotion part of it, it keeps getting better and better. We're up to 8K now that we're able to, if we wanted to, we could put it over the air. K2RIW, K2GI.
So I'm about to ask you if there's any disadvantage. In the old analog days, if I was transmitting 1080i lines, which is a certain bit rate over the air, and now I decided to transmit 4K, in the old analog days, the threshold, the signal, the DBMV required, you need a stronger signal to get above threshold. With all these fancy digital techniques, is there any major sensitivity disadvantage of 4K over the air versus 1K over the air? Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
K2IW, K2EJ. Well, we keep talking about this, and I have to get this actually, your son can help you with this one. I gotta get you this concept, okay? Let's forget about its television for a second. We got a transmitter and a receiver. We got a transmitter on a frequency by some method of modulation. It is capable of transmitting, if you want to think of it in really, in baud, okay, it's capable of transmitting, say, 38 million baud, okay, and that's a fixed value. It's always transmitting 38 million baud. Now, okay, each one of these little packets, with, you know, let's call them little mailboxes, we're transmitting 38 million mailboxes, and inside each one of those mailboxes we can put a number. Okay, and how we organize the numbers that we put in there and what their meaning is, you can transmit one video signal, two channels, three channels, five channels, 10 channels. As long as it fits within that 38 million mailboxes per second, we can do anything we want. So there's the RF part of getting these digits across, which is happening at a specific rate, and it really doesn't change much. And if you want to get more specific about that, we can do that later. And what you put inside those mailboxes have a meaning, and what you do with that doesn't have to have any relationship to the rate at which you're transmitting something, because you're transmitting that same rate forever, constantly. K2RIW, K2J.
That would suggest that if I'm watching a 4K program, I can't do it on five sub-channels simultaneously. 4-1-2-3-4-5. I can't do that simultaneously. The bits are just not there. Either that or my 4K resolution picture is going to have a very slow update rate. Your bit rate limited, I think. So 38 megapixels per second, 38 million baud is the limit. And so I presume either the number of high def sub-channels is decreased, or the update rate is decreased when I go to 4K versus 1K. Is that roughly true? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I'm going to take you, let's not start with 4K, let's start with HD. Okay? The actual real streaming rate that comes out of a camera, right, from the studio, is 2.16 gigabits per second in terms of the data rate. Right? Now, just remember that when I transmit 8VSV to your house, it's got to fit in a 6 megahertz channel, And the actual stream rate is 19.392 blah, 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 blah megabits per second. Alright? Now, actually, if I transmit my beautiful, wonderful high def signal, and I've got a couple of sub channels, I'm probably going to try it and do a trade off between what kind of content I have and the compression rates that I'm going to use. So we do these things called statistical multiplexing, which occurs in real time. But I'm going to pick a number. Let me let it drop. I'm going to send 12 million little mailboxes per second. And that's going to be my high def picture. Okay? And if I don't transmit any sub channels, I still have to throw up those 19.39 megabits with something. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to transmit for the rest of the megabytes that I have available something called null packets, or they're going to be FFs. They're going to be that particular number. If I want to add some sub channels, that means I'm, instead of sending some FFs, I'm going to take up a little more room. So I may have 12 megabytes plus a 2 megabyte standard definition stream. So now I'm using 14 megabytes. I still got some room before I hit 19. Okay. And now we're using a compression scheme called MPEG-2. So if I were to give you a comparison of the difference between the mathematics of this and that, I'm going to drop again. I'm going to take the same video source that we're making 12 megabits with an MPEG-2, and I'm going to set my MPEG-4 stream to have exactly the same resolution and the same color quality as the 12 megabit MPEG-2 stream, and to reproduce that in MPEG-4, I'm only going to need 3 megabits to make what I'm making with 12 megabits with the old standard. Okay, and each time we go around, because now besides MPEG-4, we have something called H.267 and H.265, which are more efficient than these other things. Okay, and I'm going to take you through another step. So let me let it drop it. The concept of that, I have more pixels now on my screen if I'm transmitting a 4K, which I am. I've gone from 2 megapixels to whatever it is, 8 megapixels, or even 10 megapixels. The one thing that we're not thinking about, because you're thinking about update rates, you have to update this constantly. The scheme of compression was that I may actually, in one small macro block, have the information for 12 pixels or 15 pixels across the screen, and it's only occupying one of those mailboxes going across. So as the mathematics get bigger, I still have that 19.2 megabit stream, but the efficiency of the compression that I'm using to transmit and convey the information is getting better, meaning I have to use less things. What I'm doing is passing that, the original 2.16 gigabits worth of data, I'm compressing it by 50 to 1 or more. That got me my 12 megabits, but now I can take that 2.16 gigabits of data and make it down into 3 megabits through a higher level of algorithm. Now, let me let it drop one more time. I'm being long-winded, sorry. The concept of getting from MPEG-2 to MPEG-4 to 265, 267, there's a new one called HEVC, or High Efficiency Video Coding, which makes it even smaller now. These algorithms are actually layers. The things that they've learned from MPEG-2 has a certain engine. That engine is used as a platform for MPEG-4, where the new improvements are added on top of that. With H.264, it started out with the MPEG-4 platform and all the mathematics that went behind that, and we've now added another layer. We've learned more about the eye's ability to see. We've learned more about how to do filtering and remove the elements that the eyeball doesn't see, so we don't have to transmit that information. Kind of like what Dolby did for audio, whereas if you listen to AC3, it actually makes a decision about what you need to hear
which we've done from all the physiological studies of hearing. So, give it more time, you'll see 8K in that same space. By the way, the ATSC-3 has a maximum stream rate of 38 megabits as opposed to the 1939 that we currently have now. K2RIW, K2J. Of all the possibilities you've got for transmitting the television data over the air today, yesterday, and tomorrow, how many subchannels, how many lines of resolution, what protocol being used, and so on, does any of that from today forward, depending on which one of those thousands of choices you've just given us, does any of that change the minimum signal-to-noise ratio requirement? As long as I don't change the noise figure of my front end and there's no local co-channel interference and so on, do I always have approximately the same threshold signal? Which is getting back to Joe's original question, I think. So does anything change the signal-to-noise ratio requirement today and in the future? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW. K2RIW,
good morning. Well, look, for HVSB, there is a minimal amount of signal strength and a minimal amount of cleanliness to the symbols themselves, right? And don't forget, disturbances come from the atmosphere, they come from reflections, they also come from the transmitter itself, too. Well, as the signal starts. Impulse noise along the way, nature, electric motors, hair dryers, those kinds of things. Right, with the newer system, you have a little bit less of those effects. You have different effects, actually. Because here you're transmitting essentially a thousand different areas, depending upon what level of transmission you're using. That's one of the complaints right now, is that there's too many, because you can transmit 1024 QAM, 2048 QAM, which makes it, it's actually going to make it a little difficult for the FCC to figure out what your contours are anyway. But, once that physical transmission standard is established, you got to think of it just as a pipe. So if you always meet these conditions, you're always going to get something. If the conditions are better, you don't see the difference, but that's nice. K2RIW, K2J.
What I just interpreted, there's an 8VSB pipe and there's a new ATS-3 pipe. Each of those pipes, regardless of the program content, will be constant. Is that true?
That's absolutely positively correct. Now, the interesting thing about what they call enhanced or advanced HBSB and built into the ATSC-3 standard is the ability to transmit things at a slower rate, independent from the stuff that's being transmitted at the higher rate, which is kind of really screwy the way they do it, but it's a whole interesting concept, because one type of demodulator is invisible to the other, and they don't interact with each other. That's a whole other nice discussion.
Does that mean that my handheld device, my cell phone-like thing, doing television streaming download at a lower resolution, lower update rate, will possibly have a better signal-to-noise ratio threshold as I walk around with that? Is that true, Eric? K2RIW?
Well, you want to really discuss that, you're going to have to add a couple of levels of things here. You may have heard the term buffering. When it comes to the cell phone, don't forget the cell phone is a pipe that is variable. It might be thick at times, it might be really thin, it might just disappear on you. For a moment. It is a radio, you're moving around, at least with a TV set, you're pretty constant. By the way, the ATSC-3 takes the fact that you can be moving around into consideration. And they have some neat tricks with that. But with your cell phone, with your data path, you'll find that sometimes you're in LTE, or you might be in 4G, you might be a place where there's only 3G, and you have different rates of speeds coming at you. So, in the case of your cell phone and watching video, there's a certain amount of buffering going on internally in memory, where it's actually building up the pictures, so it displays things with you. But you know damn well when you get into a bad spot, it either just stalls and waits there until it catches up with itself. because there's handshaking going on between your phone and the source, let me let it drop. A little communication going on. Say, oh, I missed this. Could you send that again, please? So there's that. Whereas that, if we're talking about, you know, the television signal, it's a fixed rate. The rate never changes. She's talking about the cell phone, depending upon the modem that you happen to be getting a good connection to, it might only be doing 100 kilobits. The next one might be only be capable of giving you 2 megabits. Another one might be giving you 10 megabits. Depends where you are, you're moving around, you know it's going to change. So you handle the picture generation part of that a little bit differently. The difference is how you display it. It's still an MPEG stream. Actually, for the cell phones, they will deliberately make it 8265 because it gives you the smallest output for that same in image. QRWK to eject.
I thank you, Eric. Lots of information. Let's make sure Joe has his original question almost answered. W2RYY, K2RYW. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I would have to say the original question is almost answered. Someday, maybe it'll be completely answered. And here's one final comment for you. There are about 5 houses within 3/4 mile of my location that have outside TV antennas with rotors. Dick, join the club.
In my little community of Dix Hills, I think I'm the only one with an outdoor antenna that's functioning. In your community, you're saying there are 2 others, you plus 2 other people, on the South Shore. Now, the good news about the South Shore is you have a nice clear line of sight to Empire and World Trade, whereas in my community, most of the people are in a valley behind a hill and can't get it. Back to you for any comment on that, Joe.
And it's Toledo.
I did not say 2 people. I said 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've seen 5 households with outside antennas that look like they put up. They're not that old looking, and they have rotors on them. So, must be a trend.
Okay, so we're not completely alone. Do you have a question on this subject, Rich N2EO K2RIW?
Excuse me. Yes, Dick. We'll go over and get on cable. You're probably going to want to give you a shot to the head. I don't know why anybody would go with man's ever being safe. I have options. So I had a. Now I have files. I got one gigabit on the internet, which I'm happy to be connected. And I have a lot of nice TV cameras. Thank you.
It's a crazy philosophy of life that Joe and I have and a few other people. In the old days, television broadcast was free over the air and everybody had it. And then along came all kinds of satellite, cable, and whatever, and a zillion channels as long as you're willing to spend $50, $100, $300 per month for television, you can get lots and lots of stuff. I just never switched over. It's just a philosophy of life that I like the old way of over the air and free. And I'm able to put antennas up high enough that I'm able to get television from multiple states. So for me, it's adequate. And there's a lot of pay-per-view programming that I'm not getting. And I managed to live without it. We're going to go over to Stan. Steve now. Steve, KC2MDP. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Steve. K2RIW. And Steve, how are the people involved when treating you? On top of that, when I go to QRZ.com and look at KC2MDP, I see this beautiful picture of a sunset with a very nice commercial radio tower. Where was that taken? I presume it was by you. Go ahead, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, that picture I think was actually taken someplace out in Utah. Like I saw, my grandfather was into the AT&T long lines years ago.
follow-up question to last week when I had that problem with the 1.2 gig mag mount, and you suggested to check the dummy load. Well, you were 100% right. At about 600 megahertz, that dummy load took off, and by the time it got to, you know, the 1.2 gig, the lower end was about 4.18, and the high end of the band was almost 5, so that was definitely my problem. I also have a question for Eric. I was just curious if the 1.2 gig machine was operational, but now that I got my antenna back in the mobile, I noticed a constant carrier on 1288, and it did ident once that I heard, and it was so fast that I was busy driving and stuff, I really didn't catch it. So, back to Ned.
You got it, Eric.
No, it should be working. Obviously you're hearing it, but now it's got me worried that it's not in tone mode. It might be a carrier scroll, and I'm hanging it open, so that's possible. But even if that's the case, to be able to talk to someone through it, if you can get somebody else to do the same thing.
For how long have you been hearing that continuous carrier on 1288, Steve?
Well, I got the antenna operational probably Friday afternoon, so I'd say off and on, probably, you know, driving around town. I just left the radio on, and I'd say, 15 minutes at a time, so I'd say Friday afternoon till probably 6 o'clock tonight, you know, off and on, I'd say.
So you've been monitoring it off and on, but it's been continuously there. The nice thing about it being continuously there, from your mobile as you drive around, you can now mentally mark all the places where you're getting good reception of 1288. So you could, in theory, you could color in your map as to the good reception areas in your town. Now, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, once I got the antenna back in operation and, I tuned to 1288, you know, I got this constant carrier. At first, I thought it was, something interfering with, the signal itself, you know, something in the car, either, you know, the LED tail lights or something like that, so I turned everything off, let it sit, and then I figured, let me drive around, so I drove around, and yeah, it was constant, you know, it was pretty much dead for quieting.
Well, at least I know that I fixed the transmitter, it works fine.
So the 5.8 VISWA on your 1296 antenna, your 23 centimeter antenna, really was a false alarm. Possibly you had used that bad dummy load as a way of calibrating your vector network analyzer. Therefore, it came up with a phony high reading, and your antenna itself was really working well right from the beginning. Is that roughly true, Steve? KC2MDP, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, it all started with the mag mount I originally had on there. It was a couple of years old. It wasn't such a great, quality mag mount. And I think, you know, over the years, water got in the cable, you know, it started to, deteriorate the signal quality. So I bought a new mag mount, and I figured, you know, before I just throw everything together, let me run a test on it and see what I have. What I did is, you know, I basically tuned up the SiteMaster with the dummy load they gave you, you know, got a perfect flat SWR, and then I had a dummy load, SO239 dummy load, and I also had an adapter that would go to an MO mount, you know, and I never even realized that dummy load probably was way out of calibration at 1.2 gigs.
Yeah, having used vector network analyzers every single day for the last 10 years, I've learned a couple of the tricks, a couple of the idiosyncrasies. When you calibrate your vector network analyzer for the end of your particular test cable, if the load that you're using is not 50 ohms, if it's, let me pick a number, 121 ohms, the vector network analyzer will do all of its internal correcting with its 12-point correction procedure with its microprocessor, and it will think, since you've told it you've put a good dummy load on there, but your real dummy load is 121 ohms, it will call that 50 ohms. From this point of view, cable has got some reflection at its connectors, the directional coupler inside. It's got some funny things going on, and it does all of that correcting because it thinks you told it you put a 50 ohm load at the end of the cable. Therefore, it does all the corrections required, so it displays as 50 ohms. So you put a bad dummy load on a vector network analyzer, when you go through its CAL procedure, you'll get crazy readings from then on. I presume you used the real CAL kit and discovered this and find out that you had to calibrate with a real good load as opposed to your particular load. Then when you measured your particular load, you found out that's where the 5.8 was. The antenna itself is probably a 1.2. It's all about roughly true, Steve, KC2, MDP, K2RIW, the tech net.
Yes, it's pretty much so, yeah. I calibrated it, you know, with the open, the short, the load, you know, that came with the SiteMaster. And being it was N connector, I didn't have an NMO to N connector for the mag mount. I found a SO239 dummy load, and of course I had the SO239 to the NMO. So, yeah, we calibrate fine with the SiteMaster open, short, and load. But when I used that other dummy load, obviously it didn't perform too good at 1.2. Back to you.
And then when you put your dummy load directly on the end of the cable, you found out that your dummy load was a 5.8. Is that true?
Thank you.
That's exactly correct.
So therefore, you had no, what's the word for it? Too bad you didn't have the right adapter. Okay. Once you find out, what was the real VISLAR of your antenna, Steve? Go ahead.
Right now, it's still a little high. It's about the lower end of the band. I'd say it's probably about 1.6. And towards the high end of the band, it's maybe a little, I'd say maybe 2.2, 2.3.
By normal standards, that's high. Not to worry. As long as your 1296, as long as your 23 centimeter equipment will tolerate it, don't worry. A 2-to-1 VISLAR, the average guy will lose a lot of sleep over that. 2-to-1 VISLAR is only half a dB loss in the worst case. As long as your transmitter doesn't go into a protect mode and goes down to lower power output. And most UHF transmitters don't give a damn about the load. Our HF equipment is very persnickety. Our no-tune 80 through 10 meter rigs, anything above a 1.6 standing wave ratio, it might start turning off or cutting back its power. But most of our VH equipment will keep right on transmitting. You can take the rubber duck antenna off your handy talkie and transmit, and it will transmit. And usually it's as crazy as it sounds, it's a safe thing to do. It's got enough beef in the final stage that it can tolerate that. Okay, Steve, good luck, and thank you for all the information. The next guy on our list was Rich, N2EO. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead with your question, Rich.
Okay, Dave. Hold on. I just took something to drink. So I don't pour. Please excuse me. I have a computer question. Is that all right?
Absolutely, it's an all right question. Although I may not be able to answer it because I'm pretty light on computers, and if we don't have a computer maven on frequency, you may have to wait until you go to the computer next. But go ahead with the question.
Okay, Dick. From a miracle help. I'm going to use, will not use, some staples. They mark it as refurbished. It's not available. Came and said with a fresh copy of Windows, it was only $173. I need it for a specific thing. Anyway, when they delivered it, I've been having nothing but trouble. But right now, I'm trying to load the internet in, so it'll pair up with my router. I'm having a difficult time with that. When it loads up, it says NEC. I'm wondering if that's Arkansas jet how back that goes. Is this a fresh copy of Windows in the end? I'm really annoyed with Staples because I think they gave me an old version for other problems, like the fan. It makes noise. Not too bad, but the last time I turned it on at the beginning of the event, give me an error message from Harry Sandy. It said that the error message said that the fan is not working properly. I was already planning to lubricate it. I think it needs a little light oil, that's all. I'm very annoyed with Staples. I wouldn't think a store of that magnitude would pull something. That's it.
Okay, if I understand correctly, Rich, so this piece of used computing equipment, supposedly with a new Microsoft Windows on it, you're finding it essentially non-operational, and I'm wondering, what's the nature of your question now? What are you really asking here, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, like I said, I gave you the list, and and there's a whole host of problems like that fan that seems like a very key location. For many problems, especially when it loads up, I'd like to know what Windows NT, how far that goes back. They didn't give me Windows, it didn't say, you know, the fresh copy of Windows. They never specified what version. Any. Do you know how far back that goes?
Maybe Eric does. KE2EJ. Windows November Echo is what I think he's saying. He wants to know how far back that goes. If you're there, Eric, go right ahead.
2000.
Okay, if that's a 2000 issue, that sounds relatively old. Over to you, Rich.
KE2EJ.
That's HUC, go right ahead.
Dick, if he's using a piece of equipment that runs Microsoft ME, there's a better than average chance that the hardware is not compatible with the newer wireless network routers. That could be why he can't connect to the internet. That stuff goes back to what was called the wireless B, and now we're into the 5 gigahertz stuff and whatnot. The letter escaped me. It went to B and then G, and now we're into the next generation of stuff. So that could be why he's not getting on the internet. KD2HC, back to that.
I'm going to go back to Steve and then go to Eric in that order. Steve, what do you believe is his chances that that particular piece of hardware that he has will accept a later version of Windows if he's able to get a copy of it? KD2HUC, K2LAW.
I would say slim to none. Usually when they sell things like that, they're selling it to people who need legacy equipment. Like if you're running, proprietary electronics, maybe some old school variable frequency drives or PLCs and stuff like that, where you need the older technology to work with that software. That's the market they're looking for. That's why you would buy it. But being able to interface it with, today's wireless, you might be able to get that computer probably even has CTMIA cards on it. You might be able to get something that will interface that will allow them to get on the internet, but probably not likely, because even the CTMIA cards have been discontinued for quite some time. KD2HC, back to that.
Steve, that doesn't sound good. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Fill me in, because I wasn't listening too closely. Did he say that he's got a machine that's running Windows 3000?
It comes up saying Windows November Echo, and somebody guessed that really is 2000. This is a used piece of equipment he bought and we're now worried that his piece of hardware, even if he had a later version of Windows, his piece of hardware may not be compatible. That's our worry. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Wireless.
So he's running Windows November Tango. Windows NT, is that correct?
No. Sorry. Windows M Mike Echo.
You got it, Eric.
Windows ME is actually a shrunk down version of Windows XP. So, it's not that old. And if he's got USB ports on there, he can hook up if he doesn't have an Ethernet adapter on it. Or doesn't have a place to hook a piece of Ethernet cable. You can get a USB to Wi-Fi adapter or Ethernet adapter, however you want to go. Of course, you have to set it up properly. You can still get drivers for Windows ME, which is the same as Windows, any 32-bit Windows. If he wants to upgrade to Windows 7, At Machine will actually go to Windows 7 32-bit. And if you get to Windows 7, then you can get to Windows 10, but, you know, that's spending money. But there shouldn't be a problem with him getting internet. Problem with Windows ME is that you wouldn't be able to get Internet Explorer that would work on it. You wouldn't be able to get Firefox, although I think they've given up on that really old stuff. So, you've got a number of different problems without being somewhat current. Not that it's a useless machine, there's other good uses for it, but not for Richie anyway. K2RW, K2J.
N2EO, you got it, Rich. Wait for the beep.
Okay, I'm gonna go with full force to a corporate headquarters of Staples. But that's their ad did not make it clear. Instead of French tapping your window. But they didn't describe which French tap. I hope you think I got a chance. I'm going to try and get out of this with a version of a better computer with a version of at least 7.1 Windows.
Is there a warranty of any kind on that rig where you could return it to them, Rich?
It's hard, Dick. Because of my medical situation, I can't pack it up in a box. It's been a real problem. Fortunately, I haven't had to return anything up now.
Yeah, I will say this much. I don't know what your money situation is or whatever that is. Don't get into it either. But, you know, there's e-machines. There's quite a number of machines out there for like $250. You got a keyboard and a display. $250, you got a computer that's kind of up to date, so you don't have to spend a fortune.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I know Eric and Dick, but I think they should make good and give it to me. Now I'll find a way to return it. What do you guys think?
W2OA over to comment on this subject.
You got it, Joe.
Back around 2000 or so, I built my first computer with parts from a computer show. Pentium 3 board, 800 meg processor, and so forth. And I was able to load originally Windows 98 on it. I tried a copy of ME, but I didn't like it. It stunk. I was able to put Windows 2000 on it and Windows XP. I tried loading Windows 7 on that computer. It loaded, but some of the stuff did not work correctly. It didn't have sound and didn't have Ethernet connection to the card on the board. It just wouldn't work. And it became a real problem trying to get drivers to make the thing work properly. So some of this hardware may not be able to work with Windows 7. The best bet is to get rid of the thing and go buy something much newer, much later in design. Because you might be just beating a dead horse trying to make that thing work with Windows 7. and anything with the old